My maternal grandmother was in her 80s when she was diagnosed with cancer, and she had a relatively peaceful passing. She was able to be at her home under my mother's care, and her pain was controlled pretty well with medication. I had a maternal great-grandfather who was somewhat frail, but seemed pretty healthy. And he announced to my mom one night that that night he was going to die. Since he was in pretty good health, my mom didn't believe him. But the next morning, she found him dead in his room. We don't know how he died or why, but he seemed to have passed peacefully. But end-of-life experiences are not always peaceful. My paternal grandfather lived into his 90s, and in his last few years, there were caretaking issues because of his loss of mobility, and he started having some issues with dementia. I was in junior high school at the time, and I have memories of him yelling angrily at my mom about things that were fabricated in his own mind. And his caretaking was draining my mom's strength. My father died in 1997 from lung cancer, and it was awful. He had terrible, scary episodes of not being able to get his breath. His only peace was when he was sleeping, which thankfully was more often as he neared death. But the worst personal experience I've probably had was watching my husband succumb to ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. For a period of about 9 months, he literally wasted away, and his last weeks were horrific. By the end, he couldn't get out of bed without help. He couldn't talk, and he could barely swallow. He was weak and emaciated and in pain. So I've witnessed peaceful death, and I've witnessed terrible death. And the ethical issues that arise at the end of life are not easy. For the next couple of episodes, we're going to be talking about those ethical issues. To learn more, join me for today's episode of All Things Apostolic. Let's talk for a moment about the end of life from a biblical perspective. First and foremost, human life is made in the image of God. It is a sacred gift and a basic and intrinsic good. Therefore, innocent life, and I do emphasize the word innocent life should not be taken intentionally. This view of human life as an intrinsic good is the basis for the insistence on equal rights under the law and equal respect for human dignity. And this intrinsic good is not dependent on a person's ability to function. In regards to death, we know that death came into the world as a result of sin. But now it is a normal and natural part of a person's life in this world. In a sense, death is both an enemy and a normal part of life. But because of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, death is a conquered enemy. This is a really critical point. For a person who is saved, death is a conquered enemy, so it does not need to always be resisted. So we care for people and we help them through the dying process. But we don't always have to do everything to stave off death, especially when it involves no more than simply delaying an inevitable death. In general, when the dying person's prognosis is very poor and further treatment is futile or more burdensome than beneficial, death can be welcomed, especially when someone is entering into a beautiful eternity with Jesus. But that doesn't mean that suicide is okay, and we'll talk more about that in the next episode. Generally, there are three ways that a physician can be involved in the death of a patient: termination of life support, physician-assisted suicide, and euthanasia. We're going to be examining each one of these, and each of them progressively involves more by the physician, a more role by the physician in the patient's death. Based on the biblical principles that innocent life cannot be taken and the timing and manner of someone's death belong to God alone, that suggests that removing life support may be okay, because death is allowed to run its natural course. But physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia are more problematic. For today's episode, we're going to focus on the termination of life support. It used to be called passive euthanasia, but it wasn't really an appropriate term because it isn't passive. It is deliberate. It generally refers to withdrawing or withholding medical treatment from a seriously ill patient and allowing the patient to die. This could include removing a ventilator that is used for breathing support. It could involve removing feeding tubes for nutrition and hydration, or not doing CPR. The case of Karen Ann Quinlan in 1975 was the first time that a U.S. court ruled on the legality of terminating life support. At just 21 years of age, Karen overdosed on drugs and seriously damaged her brain. As a result, she had gone into a coma and lapsed into a persistent vegetative state, meaning that she did not exhibit awareness, voluntarily interact with her environment, or have purposeful movements. A respirator was helping her to breathe, and a feeding tube was giving her nutrition. After 5 months in the hospital, her parents realized that she would probably never regain consciousness. So they requested that her respirator be removed so she could pass away naturally. They recounted a conversation that they had had with her to the effect that if she was ever in a condition like she was in now, she would not want to be kept alive by medical means. But when the parents asked the physicians to disconnect the respirator, the physicians refused, arguing that they would be killing Karen. They viewed the termination of life support as a departure from the standard medical treatment at that time, which was to continue treatment until the patient either died or got better. The hospital viewed the removal of life support as a form of euthanasia. In this country, there is a long tradition based on the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill, and also the Hippocratic Oath, that has prohibited doctors from assisting in suicide or actively killing their patients. A lower court ruled in favor of the hospital, refusing to grant the family's request. However, the decision was appealed to the New Jersey Supreme Court, which reversed the decision, allowing the removal of the respirator on the basis of the right to privacy, which they ruled allowed the family to make end-of-life decisions for loved ones. Interestingly, after the respirator was removed, Karen did not immediately die. In fact, she continued to live for another 10 years in a nursing home, breathing on her own until her death in 1985. Her case established the legal precedent for the termination of life support that continued to be clarified in subsequent court decisions. Another interesting case that set a legal precedent was Nancy Cruzan. As a result of a tragic auto accident and massive head injuries, Nancy was left in a permanent vegetative state. All higher brain activity had stopped, and only her involuntary functions such as heartbeat, breathing, and digestion, all functions regulated by the brainstem, continued. She had to be given life-sustaining food and liquids through a tube surgically inserted into her stomach. She was only in her late 20s, So it was possible that she would live in this condition for years or even decades. After Nancy was in this condition for roughly 7 years, her parents realized that she was not likely to regain consciousness. Her medical condition was irreversible, and the cost of giving Nancy care under these circumstances was very high. So her parents requested that the feeding tubes be removed and she be allowed to die. This case was slightly different than Karen Quinlan because Nancy's case dealt with the removal of feeding tubes, which some people considered basic care and not medical treatment. The lower court ruled in the favor of the parents. But then the Missouri Supreme Court reversed the decision. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which upheld the decision by the Missouri Supreme Court. So the family's request to have nutrition and hydration removed was denied. The court ruled that medically provided nutrition and hydration through feeding tubes qualifies as legitimate medical treatment. However, the decision opened the door for feeding tubes to be withdrawn or withheld if someone ends up in a permanent vegetative state, if they requested it in advance. But there had to be clear and convincing evidence of the patient's wish to do so. The court ruled against Nancy's parents because the court didn't believe that there was clear and convincing evidence. However, Nancy's parents gathered additional evidence from Nancy's coworkers and roommates, verifying that she did not desire to be kept alive artificially. And when this evidence was presented to the lower court, the lower court felt that the clear and convincing argument required by the Supreme Court had been met, and they allowed the feeding tubes to be removed. Nancy died within 2 weeks of the removal of the feeding tubes. So the courts have ruled that the decision to remove or withhold life support is legal. But is it moral? Not in every circumstance. For example, if a person can fully recover from an illness and they just need the ventilator temporarily for breathing support, then obviously it would be unethical to either withhold or to remove the ventilator. Or if CPR could possibly save a person's life, then it would be immoral to withhold it. Now, let me make a quick but important distinction between withdrawing and withholding treatments. Ethically, if it is acceptable to withdraw a treatment, then it is acceptable to withhold that same treatment. There is no significant moral difference between the two. Unless, for example, you want to offer a treatment in the hope that that person recovers. But you are not morally obligated to do so. And withholding a treatment once it has begun can be more emotionally difficult for family members because they feel like they are causing the death of their loved one if they withdraw it, when they are actually letting nature take its course. When life-sustaining treatments are removed, the physician does not necessarily cause the patient's death intentionally, and this is really an important distinction. The disease or condition affecting the patient is simply allowed to take its natural course. Thus, the disease or condition is responsible for the patient's death, not the doctor and not the family. In some cases, death comes quickly when life support is removed, but in other cases, it doesn't. Even though family members or medical professionals may feel that they somehow caused or contributed to the patient's death, morally, that is not the case. Removal of life support does not constitute euthanasia or assisted suicide, since death is not intentionally caused. Termination of life support is generally acceptable under three conditions. First, a competent adult patient requests it, either in writing in an advance directive or orally. Second, the treatment is futile or clearly of no benefit to the patient. And third, if the burden to the patient outweighs the benefit. For example, some end-of-life treatments actually increase the level of suffering experienced prior to death. Termination of life support is legal, and competent patients have the right under the law to refuse any form of treatment that they don't want. Some people have suggested that terminating life support is playing God by usurping the prerogative that belongs to God alone. But that charge would only be accurate if removing life support equates to killing a patient. But it doesn't. It is simply allowing death to take its natural course. So it doesn't violate the biblical prohibition against killing innocent persons. Removing a feeding tube is not starving someone to death. And removing a ventilator is not suffocating someone to death, even though it can be so difficult. In both situations, the cause of death is still the underlying disease or condition. In a way, terminating life support can be viewed as a way of turning the patient over to God and entrusting the remainder of his or her days to God. Some people believe that terminating life support violates the principle of the sanctity of life. Since life is sacred, medicine ought to be keeping people alive, and families should do whatever it takes to keep their loved ones alive. However, although life is sacred, it does not follow that medicine is obligated to keep everyone alive at all costs and at all times. This view is called vitalism. Remember, death is a conquered enemy. It does not need to be resisted at all times. It is okay to recognize that death is a doorstep to eternity, and we aren't obligated to use life support simply to delay someone's inevitable death. In doing so, we may be delaying their ability to go to heaven, where they can live forever with Jesus. And here's another key point that's so important to grasp. If the sanctity of life means that medicine is obligated to keep everyone alive at all costs and at all times, then there's a theological assumption that's problematic. There is an assumption that earthly life is the highest good. But it's not. Theologically, the ultimate good for a saved person in the community of God's people is to have eternal fellowship with God. Life here on earth is not the ultimate goal. It's better to describe it as the penultimate good. Some families want medical care at all costs, hoping for a miracle. But sometimes the miracle is that their loved one joins Jesus and receives complete healing in heaven. In our next episode, we will address physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, so be sure to tune in. Thank you for joining me for today's episode of All Things Apostolic. And until next time, take care and God bless.